Welcome to The Aperture, a podcast for curious minds and critical social thinkers, hosted by me, Steph Cutler. If you believe a better world is worth consideration, then you're in good company. Each episode, I chat with someone with views and/or experiences of a social issue, and at the end, I hand over to a creative contributor who has the final say. On this episode, I speak with Sunny Dadley about social leadership and creating social impact. I first met Sunny through our involvement with LexMove, which supports and develops lived experience leadership. It was through Sunny's experience of addiction that he became involved with an organisation, firstly as a volunteer and then developing their peer-led services. He went on to lead that organisation, which received the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service. More recently, Sunny can be found working as a freelance speaker and social impact consultant, and he's a respected and recognised spokesperson on policy reform and system change. Our guest poet today is Ibrahim Ismail. Ivy is the development manager at Bolton Solidarity Community Association, which works primarily with new communities in Bolton. In addition, he is the deputy chair and non-executive director of Bolton at Home and the chair of Bolton Council for Voluntary Service. Ibby enjoys writing poetry in his spare time, and he took some time out to write a poem in response to my conversation with Sunny. Sunny goes as social leadership guy, so I began by asking him what social leadership means to him.
Oh, so for me, my journey of social leadership really bore out of some really difficult experiences I had, particularly in my early life. Without going into a massive amount of detail, I became addicted to Class A drugs. That had a really big impact in terms of my life, my ability to live my life with meaning and purpose. And yeah, at one point in my life, I wasn't too sure how it was going to turn out, where I would end up, or in what state I would be in. Mm-hmm. So I accessed healthcare treatment services for, you know, on and off for about 10 years. And eventually, I was able to embark upon an intervention that would, have a massive impact on my life. And that was a community detox, which I had to fight for my right to receive. And, you know, really at that point where I was still very vulnerable, for anyone that's vulnerable to come forward and say, you know, I need this or I need that, it should be met with a response that at least encourages some thinking around that. But for me, I was met with quite a lot of resistance, but I stuck to my guns and I said, no, this is really what I want. And I managed to undertake a community detoxification, which lasted about 10 days back in 2007, but felt like 10 years.
Yeah.
And not very long after that, a week or so after I got married, I then flew on honeymoon. I landed back in the UK, and I wasn't sure about who I was, what I wanted to do. But one thing I did know is that I didn't feel that, you know, me and people like me were treated as they should be in terms of their human rights and dignity. So I started exploring ways in which I could use my experiences to give back. And that, you know, was very self-driven. There weren't many other people or organizations that were able to offer that type of support and guidance. So I began a journey of volunteering and really enjoyed, you know, very simple tasks such as making cups of tea for people or playing a game of pool with them or just sitting and listening to what they were going through. You know, at that period of my life, that was the perfect thing for me because it reinforced my decision to change, but then also allowed me to draw upon my experiences to be able to connect with other people. This period of volunteering went on for around about 3 or 4 months. I volunteered at a couple of organizations. And the next part was that I actually was offered a role initially as a project worker for a newly formed organization. So I joined as a part-time project worker, but within a month I was in a leadership position. And it's from that leadership position really where I started analyzing policy, practice, procedure across society and taking into consideration the experiences of people like myself who had gone through difficult times. Interestingly, I didn't necessarily see myself as a leader, I just felt that I was there to do the best that I could do for the people that I was working alongside. And, you know, other people then would start, you know, calling me a leader, a social leader, because what I was doing is I was not only taking time out to sit down and listen to people's experiences, whether they were in prison or in the community or single moms or whoever it may be. But then I was also, you know, I began a journey of strategic involvement. So what happened during that point was that I had my own lived experience, as well as increasing numbers of people that I was consulting with and speaking to and learning from. And whilst at the same time, I, you know, began being exposed to strategic partners, boards, thinking, funding. And I really noticed a huge disparity between the experiences of people in the community and, you know, the political and strategic aspirations of local governments, national governments. So I've always been the sort of guy to ask questions, because for me, it's only by asking questions that we can get a better understanding. So I'd be the, you know, really probably annoying person in the room that would ask questions about, you know, who, you know, such as who wrote this strategy? Why is this seen as a really important target? Because in the back of my mind, I had a really deep and thorough understanding of some of the key challenges that the communities were faced with. You know, initially I would feed this stuff back, ask questions. Often I would not find the response to questions I was asking was sufficient to cover it. So then, you know, I was left with a decision. I could either just feed back to the community, well, this happens for this reason and that's not going to change. But that didn't sit well with me. So instead, I developed the organization to be able to provide much more comprehensive support to individuals, because the system, not necessarily individuals, but the system was letting people down. I then started building a whole heap of evidence around, you know, what the solutions were to some of these systemic barriers. And in essence, I suppose, when I cast my mind back to what, 12 or 13 years ago, all that we were doing is we were circumnavigating complex and cumbersome systems alongside people that found it difficult to do so themselves. And there's lots of reasons why people don't access the right level or depth of service. But by having an advocate, by having somebody on their side with them, telling them, you know, explaining what their rights are, explaining what the processes and procedures are. So, for example, you know, housing and homelessness was and is a massive deal for a lot of people who have problematic use of drugs. So, you know, we'd look at law, we'd understand, I'd make sure myself and my team understood any changes in law. We'd meet with the local homelessness services just to find out what their processes were like, what kind of waiting lists they had. So that's one example of ways in which we did more than offer people a voice and a chance to have their say. We actually would actually, you know, physically intervene and provide support so that people had the best opportunity moving forward. So through all of this learning and this journey, you know, people, you know, from different walks of life would then, you know, started seeing me as a leader before necessarily I recognized it myself. So for me, social leadership is basically doing the right thing by society. And if people want to see me in a particular light for doing that, then I'm absolutely humbled that that's the case. But we need to create more social leaders in every town and city across the UK and the world until, you know, we reach a level of equality that everyone is comfortable with.
So with this deep and thorough understanding and experience that you undoubtedly have, what are your thoughts on current UK drug policy?
Yeah, so current UK drug policy has been born out of, you know, decisions that were made over 100 years ago around certain drugs and psychoactive substances. You know, I would suggest that they were racist policies to begin with. And as time's gone on, what's happened as a result is that, you know, many non-drug using people within society have been given messages about people that use drugs as being bad people, that do bad things, and it's their own fault. And you know, in terms of the current state of play, it's just a completely unfair and unjust system. And it's untenable that we can even consider continuing in this way. I'm very much of the thought that we need to support people rather than punish people who use drugs. I don't feel that necessarily incarcerating somebody and taking away their rights will have the desired impact. And we only have to look at some of the statistics around, recidivism and the number of people that actually start using drugs in prison to understand that it's not working. It never has worked. Yet where we find ourselves in a position whereby we see this as the staple intervention to use for people with addiction, mental health and homelessness issues, and it has to change.
It sometimes feels, doesn't it, like it's going to take a really courageous government to make the necessary change. And I wonder what sort of reform you'd like to see in place.
I've been lucky to go to different countries that have got slightly different approaches to their drug policy. And, you know, the one that's cited most internationally is the Portuguese model. And Portugal, back in the late 1990s, had a real problem around particularly injecting drug use, bloodborne viruses and diseases being spread, and crime that was associated with this drug use. And, you know, they made the what some may see as a radical decision to decriminalise personal drug use. So basically, if somebody was caught with drugs that was for their own use, then rather than being dealt with by the criminal justice system, they'd be signposted to health services. I mean, I can only relate it to my personal experience. So when I was inactive in my drug use, I wasn't a criminal. I wasn't a threat to anybody. But the fact that, you know, society and policy automatically labelled me as being a criminal by virtue of me using drugs, that in itself didn't stop me from continuing that drug use. You know, interaction with the criminal justice system did not stop me continuing with my drug use. The thing that can help me to discontinue my drug use was when I found a greater purpose for my life. And I think all of us deserve to achieve and to find and to explore what their purpose in life is. So what I would call for is, you know, an approach that really is holistic in its setup, whereby we can actually look at the person behind the use of drugs. And there's a great deal of evidence around things like adverse childhood experiences and the impact that can have. So if we were to frame it in a way to say, well, actually, as young people, as children, you know, a large percentage of people who use drugs problematically had suffered some horrific trauma, then would we then continue to traumatise them and send them to prison and take away their rights, when in actual fact, what we need to do is to help people to address their trauma, to realise their passion and to, you know, be productive in their own life. And for me, that is a much more humane, common sense, cost-effective way of dealing with drugs within society.
It feels like that would be a much more sensible use of taxpayers' money too.
Yeah. I mean, the hundreds of millions of pounds that are spent on this facade that is the war on drugs to achieve the outputs and outcomes as a result of that massive investment, you know, the government should be hanging their head in shame. And the taxpayer should be, you know, up in arms, because it's glaringly obvious that approach isn't working. I mean, the average cost of incarcerating somebody in a UK prison for 12 months is around about £42,000-£45,000. And just imagine what, you know, and as somebody that's lived that life and who managed a service that didn't, you know, receive much more than incarcerating one or two people in prison a year, you know, the impact that could have could be phenomenal. You know, we could actually, you know, start to help people to rebuild their lives, to find themselves in safe and comfortable housing, to retrain, upskill, to work on, you know, creating positive social networks. And it would cost a fraction compared to the current approach. So, yeah, there are alternatives. We do need some brave decision making. And I mean, the Portuguese model is an interesting one, because the public, although they were really cheesed off with, you know, what was happening with drugs on their streets and in their cities and towns, initially weren't all that supportive of decriminalisation. And then as soon as, you know, the outcomes started being released around a reduction in drug use, a reduction in antisocial behaviour, lower numbers of people you know, suffering harm and fatalities as a result of using drugs, and then, you know, that the public, you know, became on side. So at some point we need someone or a group of people to stand up and make a brave decision.
Absolutely. And you've been advising on this, haven't you?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been advising on this for a number of years in different forms. So I've been part of all party parliamentary groups, but more recently, I was the independent ambassador for the Labour campaign for drug policy reform. And at the time of recording this, we're at the final stages of completing our recommendations that will be put forward to the front bench. So very senior ministers within the Labour Party. I've also been working with the Conservative Drug Policy Reform Group, writing articles and supporting what they're doing. So there are some enlightened people within political parties that understand the sheer impact, negative impact of our current drug policy. So now it's about how we can make that message much more consistent, where we can have cross-party agreement on a future approach. And for me, this is, you know, it's beyond any one political party. It's beyond any one term in office.
Talking politics, Sunny, you've been involved with Operation Black Vote. Can you say a bit about why they exist and your involvement with them?
Yeah, so Operation Black Vote, or OBV, was set up in the 1970s here in the UK to encourage people from the black community to exercise their right to vote. So they're a non-partisan organisation, quite a small team, but very powerful, who over a few decades ago have been encouraging people to register to vote. If you're not registered to vote, how can you have your say? How can you then criticise decisions that are being made if you haven't actually casted your vote? My involvement with them began in 2013 when I applied for a civic leadership programme in the West Midlands. And it was a really fantastic opportunity for somebody like me who had worked in the community and voluntary sector for a little while at that point to understand the role of civil society, civic roles. So, you know, we had training and shadowed various people. So I shadowed the leader of the local authority in the city where I live for around about 3 months. I supported a prospective member of the European Parliament with her campaign, not because I necessarily believed in her, you know, policy ideas, but I wanted to get a greater understanding in terms of how that process worked. And obviously, you know, that involvement within the European Parliament and politics isn't necessarily as it was then. It was still really interesting to find out more about the workings of the democratic system. And then more recently, back in 2018, I applied for another programme with them, which was a parliamentary shadowing programme. So I shadowed a member of parliament for 12 months, both in the constituency and also in the local office. And again, it was an opportunity for me to you know, go behind the scenes of a member of parliament, you know, look at how they approach the role, various interactions that they have with constituents, other parliamentarians. And it was a really enlightening experience.
Is politics in the future a possibility for you, Sunny?
We can't get away from the fact that politics controls everything in life. And for me, my journey of following where the power came from around the decisions that were made that were impacting on the communities in which I lived and worked, ultimately went back to central government. Yeah. So I couldn't say definitively that that's something that I would rule out. What I would say is, having spent time with a serving member of parliament, that the role is all consuming. It's literally 7 days a week. And as I've got three young children, I mean, they're getting a little bit older now. So perhaps it's something I can start considering a little bit more. But, you know, I could never rule out that might be one day where I, you know, dedicate my efforts, because my life is committed to creating change. And if through politics and politics with a big P, I'm given the opportunity to do that, then I would grasp it with both hands. But I also think that there's other ways in which me, people like me and other people can create change. And
yeah, that's, I was about to say that. It's almost like there's more than one way to create social change, politics being one. Yes. And I imagine your degree, it's about creating sustainable social change. And how can you find ways outside of politics then to create sustainable social change?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything from the micro to the macro level. So it's conversations that we have with other people. It's how we can look to influence organisational culture, perhaps working with the funders to understand how they could make their funding much more socially aware, or could achieve a greater level of overall impact if it was done in some form of, you know, synchronisation. So if, you know, 10 of the major funders in the UK perhaps got together, and I don't know, maybe they do this, but actually plan their funding in such a way, then perhaps that could, you know, look at, you know, creating systemic change. And then more recently, the things I'm looking at are things such as alternative funding opportunities. You know, for me, how can we drive up innovation in practice and the mechanisms and levers to allow that to happen? So I'm increasingly interested in things like impact investment, social impact bonds, because they provide an opportunity to innovate in ways that other traditional funding methods perhaps don't. So I think that there's lots of ways in which we can create change. I think it's something that each of us have to take responsibility for. And I think, you know, also we have to call out when things are not being done in a way that is conducive of a good society. So if you think about some of the inequalities that exist, if we think about race discrimination, if we think about poor practice, if we look at health inequalities, I mean, these are all areas that would within themselves create some sort of social change. Most importantly for me, it's about, you know, how we can improve the lives of and the life outcomes for everybody. But if we were to do it in a much more joined up way, then perhaps we could actually start measuring some of the wider social impact rather than relying on individual funders or individual organizations. So that's ultimately, you know, what I'm aiming for. And I'm excited at the prospect of doing so.
I think most people would agree we need to be more joined up in these and be more compassionate and take people with us much more, in terms of the people who this stuff affects are not usually sufficiently involved. And I don't just mean involvement, you know, it's about creating opportunities, isn't it? Like I know you did in your previous organization, to actually utilize the talents and the experiences of those who this is affected. And I think, you know, yourself, social leadership guy, Sunny, are a fantastic example of that. In fact, you know, Sunny Dadley for PM. How about that? Thanks go to social leadership guy, Sunny Dadley. And now over to Ibrahim Ismail. Ibby and I are both Claws Social Leadership Fellows. And on our leadership residentials, Ibby would keep us all entertained by making up poems about our experiences. So he was a perfect person to invite to be our guest poet on this episode of The Aperture.
Sunny Day by Ibby Ismail. What makes a good social leader? Is it based on an individual's dream? Do we have a formula to follow? Maybe some common themes? How do you know? When can one tell? Will struggle be a part, a drive brought from personal hell? The need for resistance, which turns to persistence. A system in need of change, a sense of insistence. A wish to change direction where the strategy lacks. The need to gain power and then give it back. A journey, a path which you walk alone, and yet you need others to walk in tow. Doors open for opportunity, for someone to make a stance. Volunteer to be here and take a chance. You may not comprehend while others see your way. From the storm of lived experience, there is a sunny day.
That's it from me, Steph Cutler. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe so you don't miss a future episode of The Aperture on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please like, share, leave a review, and The Aperture can be found on Facebook and Twitter. This episode of The Aperture was produced by VI Podcasting. See you next time for more social change thinking.